I've been musing about something about this having a breach with the land, the language you use.
My curiosity is that, you know, it takes consciousness to enter into a breach in basic contract law. Two people have to know what they're doing. The land, I don't think, is ever identified as conscious or sentient. And in this text that you just put forth before us, the land is described as God's, which is an ownership relationship, not a contractual relationship, a breach relationship. I'm not sure why this is kind of floating around in my brain. I'm just wondering if you want to help me unpack that a little bit, because I think they mean different things. So the other piece is that I'm not sure it's ownership. It could also be an extension. The land is mine. It is me. And so that's a different relationship, again, than otherizing the land. Then, you know, you need another in order to have a breach. So I'm not sure that God is saying that there's a covenant with the land. It's just the land is God.
I think that's a good, sensitive question. My impression is that we are also gods in that same sense. Mm-hmm. And so that lack of otherness applies to us, and so the question of breach would apply to us. But it isn't. I think it's more clear in the Noach text that the covenant is with the land, and it's a covenant, a triangular covenant between humans, God, and land. So the covenant God makes with the land is that summer and winter, cold and heat will not cease. Lo yishbota. And the covenant essentially might be thought of as saying, no matter what the humans do, I'm not going to destroy you, land. In essence, what happens in the Noach story is that what used to be a fused relationship between humans and land becomes two separate covenants. Covenant isn't not contract in that sense. That is, we have both covenant and contract with God. And because they come together all the time, it's easy to think of them as the same thing. But I think actually that may not be true. But it's very well worth debating further. I'm not sure that my interpretation is best.
And it's not clear to me that covenant is always mutual and agreed. I mean, Mila is not agreed to by an eight-day-old infant. By the father and the people, you know, and the people at Sinai agreed to it for future generations.
Right. And it's not, just the sign of the breach, it's not the breach.
But maybe breach means something different from what we think of as contractual relationship. Maybe breach is something that describes a relationship that has force to it or consequences to it.
That you sat down, negotiated over the details, came to an agreement and entered into a covenant, but
the way things are set up is covenantal.
Well, that is one of the interpretations, right, when we look at Middle Eastern covenant documents between kings and vassal states, that it looks like it's overwhelming power forced onto the vassal state. Again, a very reasonable reading. In some ways, it doesn't correspond to how I see it, but it's worth discussing more, for sure. You know, my personal understanding of what makes a breach essentially a breach is that on one side, the breach applies to people who are not able or are not there to agree with it. That is the covenant. It's a covenant because it's not just with me who's agreeing, but with all of my descendants who don't have a chance to agree. Or between me, the covenant, there's a priestly covenant, Brit Shalom, right? Because the priest made a covenant on behalf of the whole people and not just on behalf of themselves. So it just, from what I can tell, every instance of Brit has that structural characteristic.
Maybe that's the difference between a covenant and a contract, because a contract would just be with the one individual.
Right. That also happens to correspond to our idea of covenant in the negative sense, like real estate covenants, that it applies to all the people down the road who buy the land, whether you agree to it or not. So that may actually be a good, you know, translation into English, but somewhat separate from our question here. Any other comments at the moment? Yeah, the break goes on. That's why you're here, to say things like that. Just for the record, that was Larry Edwards who said that. any other comments at the moment? Yeah. Do we want to talk more about the tachlis of Shemitah, or do we not need to do that? You see, I'm not talking about what they do in Israel now. Now, of course, one of the things that we haven't mentioned is that supposedly they never actually did these laws. And we don't even know if they're practicable. And could we ever do the kind of uniform land distribution which would make it possible to enact the system? That is, you can't have this system of economic justice unless you start from ground zero equality. Without it, there's no just standard to go back to. And we've never had such a just standard in this country or in any country that I know about. That's probably not true, but that we know about.
I guess my question is about practical effect. If we see this as sort of a Mashiach type kind of idea, and we're striving toward an understanding between land.
I think we can reach it to you.
We're striving for an understanding that there is this connection, this covenantal connection between humans, land, and God. And we're not in that relationship right now. We're in a state of brokenness, either post-Noah or because we're, you know, these laws have never been practiced. Then, you know, what do we have today? What do we want to strive for in the now?
Does anyone want to respond to that besides me and before me? I mean, if these are rights, then they have immediate ethical implications, and they also project onto a future ideal. That is, rights in both the religious and not just the legal sense. So we can talk about both, or we can talk about either one. It's not that complicated to do both. But we can look, for example, at some of the stuff that Alto Leopold talks about in the second column. And see how that might translate into standards that we could talk about in terms of halacha. For example, although I'm not sure that it's necessary to turn it into halachak at this stage anyway. Obviously, if we want to make it normatively Jewish, we need to make it into halacha as well, right? At least for much of the community. So I'm trying to decide if we need to read this whole thing or what we should read of it. We have enough time to read a fair amount, though, so I guess I'll do some. See?
Will there be time in the session to talk about how we apply this? Or
that's really what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, will we have time for that if we read more of the quotes?
Yeah.
And if other people are interested, Josh is interested, but I don't know if people are interested in that, like, you know, doing.
Yeah, we will. We will, but maybe from what I'm hearing in that question, we should do a little more talkless right away in that sense.
There's some theoretical that needs to be fed into that talkless.
Yeah. Well, the theoretical, I would feed into it the first theoretical point, which comes directly out of Shemitah and Yovel, as well as being completely permeating Aldo Leopold's idea of a land ethic, is that property is not right. One of the things that is not human right is what we think of as property. There's a different notion of, completely different notion of property articulated in the Yovel laws, which doesn't mean the right to dispose of or use, but the right, the responsibility to take care of. And when we change our notion of property in that way, there's a lot of very immediate practical consequences on all levels of society that immediately come into force. So that's one theoretical to feed into it. Another theoretical to feed into it is that if humans do have this kind of responsibility to respect the rights of other species or other beings or the land, the earth, then we get to the question of, are we talking about individual animals? Are we talking about individual species?